Hey guys, my name is Fane Mensah, head of the scientific community, and welcome to season 2 of Cap Talk, the podcast that talks to the who's who in computer-aided biology. This season, David and I will cover various themes at the intersection of biology and technology, from hiring and team building to data strategies, from bioprocessing to Internet of Things. We're really excited to welcome a new guest and gain some new insights. You can hail the cab at revolutionaries@computeratedbiology.com to tell us where to take you next. And to stay up to date, you can find all our great content on computeratedbiology.com. Enjoy the next episode and don't forget to like and subscribe.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Computer Aided Biology podcast, Cap Talk. As usual, I'm here with my co-host, Fane Mensah, head of the Computer Aided Biology community.
Hi, everyone.
And we are joined this week by Mike Farrow, former CEO of TeslaGen.
Hello.
As always, you can check out the Computer Aided Biology website, computeratedbiology.com, for the latest news, jobs, events, everything you can think of in Computer Aided Biology. We're going to start this week. I'm going to start this podcast talking about something on my mind today, which is COVID, because I've just had my second dose of the BioNTech Pfizer vaccine. And I think it's really cool that I have little mRNAs now swimming through my cells and, creating a vaccine. That is kind of awesome. I'm not sure if I'm going to suffer any side effects because there's a heat wave at the moment. And I'm feeling very warm and exhausted as a matter of course. So maybe I'll be fine.
I think you'll be fine, David.
I think I'm feeling very optimistic about it. My arm was a little dead this morning, but it's actually much better now. So happy days. But now we've got the Delta variant kind of ripping through the communities, and the vaccines don't seem to be as effective in terms of stopping the spread. How are things down in London, Fane?
Yeah, it's been a big week, I think, throughout the UK since Monday, everything opened again. I think we called it
No More Rules.
No More Rules, Freedom Day, which has been embraced by a lot of the especially younger people. But yeah, it's the numbers are increasing. I do have to say what is quite promising in that in the UK, we've got quite a good rate of vaccination. So David, yes, you added to that success, which is great. Ooh. Yeah, I think it's just we need to see how things roll out. It's definitely different than when the cases rose in, was it end of the year, beginning of the year? Mm. Now a lot more people are vaccinated, especially the vulnerable people that we need to look after are all vaccinated. But yeah, the younger generations are now spreading it. So I think it's, we need to see what's happening.
Mike, what's the situation in the US?
Well, this is America, so there are probably about 100 million different opinions about what the situation is in this country. But I'm here in California, which has been open for a while. We have fairly good vaccination rates as well. But the Delta variant is spreading, as Fane said, among young people especially. And having an abundance of caution, LA County has reinstituted wearing masks indoors, which seems like a pretty modest requirement. It was pretty bad in LA County where I am right now about a year ago, this last winter. So I think they're just trying to be very cautious and see what they can do to tamp this thing down.
Mike, first of all, I'm really, really happy that you're joining us. We met, I think, a year ago, Symbiobeta. We did a really nice panel discussion on the various technologies in life sciences R&D. And I'm very, very pleased that you're joining us today. Back then, I didn't get the chance to really ask you, where did you start? How did you come up with the idea as a founder of TeslaGen? So I think this is a great opportunity to just, if you can just give us a brief introduction into who you are, what your background is, and perhaps a bit of an introduction in why you founded TeslaGen.
Sure, happy to do that. So I'm a bit of an oddball in some sense. I have a very sort of heterogeneous, nonlinear background. I started my academic career in physics, in particular high energy physics. So I spent a good solid decade after my PhD working at both CERN and Stanford, trying to understand the electroweak interaction and the Z boson, as it's called, sort of like a heavy, very, very, very heavy photon. And it was a great career. I thought that's what I was going to do the rest of my life. And then a few things happened in the 90s. The government killed what was then called the Superconducting Super Collider, or SSC. So it was a mega project that was supposed to go into the Texas desert and be the world's biggest particle accelerator. And it was killed. It got quite far along until they picked the site. When they picked the site in Texas, all of a sudden, none of the other states were interested in funding it. It's like they put all their eggs in one basket, and then they took the basket away. Meanwhile, there's another machine being planned and built in a much more, probably somewhat less political and more rational way in Europe at CERN, on the border of France and Switzerland. And it became clear in the mid-90s that that is where the so-called LHC is where sort of the next step in high energy physics was going to be taken. So, I had finished a big experiment at SLAC. We'd done the world's best measurement of the Weinberg angle, and I was thinking, well, I can sign up. It's not like being in the military in high energy physics. You can sign up for another hitch, you know, like a 15-year hitch and go after the Higgs boson or think about something else to do with your life. And I was very intrigued by biology. I had a brother-in-law who's a biophysicist, and he got me kind of thinking about it. I reached out to some companies, and through hook or crook, I wound up at a bioinformatics company. I left high energy physics. Went to this really interesting little bioinformatics company, which led me back to Stanford working with a guy named Pat Brown, who's since started Impossible Foods. But back then he was working on with David Botstein, who was the chair of the Department of Genetics at the time, on gene chips or gene microarrays. So expression analysis. And I'm coming from physics. I don't know anything. I mean, it's really horrible how poorly educated scientists are about other science. I'm sure it goes both ways, but I didn't really know anything about what was going on at the molecular level and in biology, and sort of fascinating science of complexity, really. High energy physics is all about reductionism, right? It's this science of supposed simplicity and trying to understand things that, you know, fundamental constituents and fundamental forces. Whereas biology is all about the science of complexity. You have these fundamental building blocks, but then you have many levels of hierarchy on top of that that eventually get you to these amazing little nanomachines, which, you know, make up our bodies and our cells. And anyway, that was just like a revelation to me in the late 90s, and working with Pat and David and trying to understand what it was they were doing with taking this essentially a snapshot of the transcriptional activity of a cell using these gene chips. So I was all in at that point. Stanford asked me to sort of expand their gene expression technology into a core facility, which I thought, okay, this is fine, but it's going to be boring after a couple of years. So I told them I would do it. But I also wrote for my own grant money and got my own NIH fellowship, something they call a K-25, which is aimed at people like me who are in the physical sciences but wanted to transition to biology. And so they gave me, they gave me $1 million in 4 years to just goof around and do my own research. And I wound up in a microbiology research with Lucy Shapiro and Harlan McAdams, who were doing stuff in kind of a way that appealed to a lot of us who come from engineering background. They're trying to find sort of fundamental descriptions of the bacterial cell cycle from sort of very, you know, mechanistic and modeling level. It was really quite interesting what they're doing, but I won't go into detail about you know exactly what we're doing in that lab. But it was a great education in molecular microbiology, and it's there. I don't, you know, all companies have an origin story, right? And it's there that's where I met my co-founders.
Okay,
so I went from physics to Pat and David, to writing this grant, to falling in with Lucy and Harley, and then I met my co-founders Nathan and Eduardo. that's kind of the origin story of that.
And what's quite interesting is that meeting various people, that do you think that they all guided you to where you are now, or is it coincidence?
Well, I mean, coming from, you know, physicists are essentially software developers now, or analysts, you know, they do they build big machines and then they analyze data for a long time. So compared to most of the folks in biology, I had a fairly solid, you know, computer science and coding background. And so they tend to, like, you know, you tend to get pushed into those areas like, hey, can you build this for me? Hey, can you do that for me? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
It became very clear that even though biologists, because they're late adopters of, you know, say software and modeling, you know, on a historic scale compared to say engineering and physics, they're early adopters of web technologies. So a lot of the stuff was being done, you know, biologists love just, you know, going to a browser and blasting a sequence and NCBI and stuff like that. So they're actually pretty early adopters of web-based analysis, whereas us physicists were still, you know, right, coding in Fortran. And so it was actually kind of fun to see how biologists used sort of more modern paradigms for interacting with computers and so of course we were the ones who had to build a lot of the tooling for the experiments we were doing, software tooling and so forth. So that was an introduction to sort of coding for biology, if you will.
Well, that's really cool. I think we often talk about like silos in within biology itself, that there's kind of data and knowledge all kept in different silos. And we forget that even just across the sciences in general, we can all interact and we should all interact. Was it a very eye-opening experience for you then to kind of see things from that perspective, and vice versa, biologists that you worked with, did you blow their minds?
I think I was the one who's having, you know, his mind blown, if you were. I mean, everyone was intrigued by my background. A lot of them, people thought I was an engineer. I don't want to insult engineers by being insulted by that. So, because, you know, that's the skill set that was transferable, right? I think I was the one who was really, learning a lot. Two things I noticed right away: there's a lot more gender equality and gender balance in biological sciences than in high energy physics. So it's kind of refreshing being a more normal, kind of less macho science. And the other thing is that they're very open to, you know, adopting new technologies and new ways of doing things. Like I just said, you know, web-based approaches to stuff. So.
Yeah, talking about adapting new technologies, that's the topic that we really talked a lot about last year at SymbioBeta. Celligen, your company that you founded, I can put it in a box of new technologies. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's behind the idea about Celligen? What problem did you identify, and what type of solutions were you thinking of?
Sure. Yeah. So at Tecelligen, we're developing, you know, what we call a digital backbone for biotechnology companies. And, you know, what's clear is that, you know, biology as an engineering discipline is a good, let's be honest, good 20, 30 years behind or, you know, classical engineering or electronic engineering or electrical engineering or what have you. And in those industries, you can see the pattern of development that occurred, you know, over a few decades, where people developed computer-aided design tooling, and they developed, you know, systems for sharing and so forth. A lot of it based, however, on the ability to model. So, you know, if you're in a physics-driven engineering discipline like, you know, mechanical electrical engineering, you do have sort of fundamental handle on the physics of the situation, and you can do simulations either through direct calculation or through Monte Carlo methods. So if you look at a lot of the EDA software, it's really built around, you know, Monte Carlo simulation of noise and different things. That's not the case in biology. And with all due respect to the tremendous amount of efforts being done on simulation, and that's, I don't want to get myself in trouble here, but I just want to just draw the distinction. That you don't always have the ability to model something at a fundamental level. Now, of course, that comes with a million caveats. There's lots of really good work being done, especially in protein folding, some really revolutionary stuff happening right now. But in general, the complexity of the system, we're talking about complexity, you know, not reductionism, lends itself more to a discovery process that is more like what nature does. So, instead of always going, I don't want to get myself in trouble with modelers, because the modeling part is absolutely essential to hypothesis-based reduction, which we'll get into in a minute. But fundamentally, what biologists do and what biology allows you to do so efficiently is to do selections and screens based on the biology. So you let the biology guide you to the answer. So trying to shoehorn you know, biology into an engineering paradigm, for especially for informatics and for helping people get the answers to their problems, is not necessarily a good idea. It has to be, of course, it's always there as a tool, but you shouldn't like force people down that path. I think a lot of academic, pure academic tooling, it may come out of academia and realize it doesn't have a market, because that can only take people so far. And then they need to get the rest of the way. I'm being a little obscure there, but hopefully.
You've got the platform to be to do that, Mike. That's no problem. Absolutely.
So what we're trying to enable is that kind of, you know, biologist driven approach to, you know, developing a molecule or a bioproduct. And what that really, really amounts to is doing what nature does. Nature tries a lot of things, and so do drug developers. So do, you know, industrial biotechnologists. They do, you know, what are called high throughput screens. High throughput screens are not necessarily done very efficiently. It's much better if you have a good reporter selection, obviously, but nevertheless, you can do various kinds of screens that allow you to sort of pick out of the milieu or this vast space of possible, you know, possible answers to your problem, the one that's going to work for you. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what we've tried to enable. Now, as I mentioned before, when you just naively go and say, well, what's the dimensionality of this space? You know, if I modify these, you know, residues or these domains of an antibody or whatever, it's like, oh, I'll start to count up how many different variants I have. I just like more variants than grains of sand on the beaches of the world or something. That's crazy. I can't do that. So that's where modeling and sort of this hypothesis-based reduction comes in. You have to have a handle on what it is you're trying to do and find those parts of this space that really make sense based on your you know, prior knowledge or modeling and simulation. But in the end, what we find is our customers usually have not one or two or three, but hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of possibilities that they still wind up with wanting to test in a very efficient way.
Yeah, so you mentioned the modeling bit, obviously, yes, biology does it by itself, as you said already. But when technology comes in, what's that added thing that you could, how do I say that? What's the new thing that you can do with technology now compared to if you just let biology do it? What are the areas where you think like the technology that you're using at the Celligen are a game changer or different?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously the holy grail is a genetic selection with, you know, a clear reporter and a, you know, phenotype, and you could engineer something where you just pop your solution out of the background. It just isn't always that easy. And so then people get into the idea of, well, I'm going to try a lot of different things that are very close to what I think is optimal, or close to what I'm trying to do, and just see if I can find the one that's the best. And we did a lot of this at Stanford. We were doing a high throughput microscopy, actually. So we're looking at individual microbial cells at the, you know, subcellular levels, looking for reporter proteins that were lighting up inside of a cell. And, you know, typical screen might be like 30,000, and we had to take pictures of, you know, colonies of all 30,000 of these different genetically modified strains and so forth. So that's just a lot. It's a lot of work. So there's just the management of that, obviously, is one part of it. And that speaks to the sort of systematic error. You want to be able to manage it well, otherwise you can introduce systematic errors that are going to blow your screen out of water. And then there's the statistical component, where you want to have enough data to have a good, clean answer. And what we've tried to enable at Celligen is both control over those statistical and systematic errors, so that people can do what we call iterative machine learning. So we have some tooling we developed that's pre-built, you know, models that allow you to start learning from screens early and often. So you don't have to run the full 100,000, you know, variants that you have in the freezer. You might run 1,000 and then, or even 100, and then feed that to the model, and the model will suggest to you where to go next in your screen. So now you have a screen that could have taken a long time and a lot of money. It can be done much more quickly in a matter of months.
So Mike, tell me a little bit about how Celligen kind of articulates itself then to potential customers? Because this is the thing that I'm always very curious about is these are the same challenges faced by biologists worldwide, but these solutions and these kind of roots are not always obvious. And biologists, as you said, are kind of keen to take up new technologies. They are early adopters of the web-based kind of technology. What? How do you articulate the challenge ahead to them when you're positioning TeslaGen?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because a lot of companies that are developing, say, software solutions for biology writ large, wind up having to use a lot of the same marketing kind of, you know, memes or whatever. You know, they have to say AI this, or, you know, reduction of silos and you know, sharing and whatever. So, you know, they all wind up saying the same thing. So it is a little bit confusing. I think there's a little bit of market confusion among this new generation of software companies that's developing solutions, because all of them have come at it from slightly different directions and, in fact, you know, bring value in slightly different ways. So you have to drill down after you've sort of made your initial contact with your customer. You really have to find out whether your customer is really, you know, really needs, or what their needs and wants are, and see if there's really a fit. The inverse of that is also true. When you're just starting a company, you probably want to know what your customer's needs and wants are, and not necessarily try to, you know, hit them over the head with your hammer that you built. Say, I got this great hammer, damn it. But that's, you know, at the stage we're at with TeslaGen, we've done that discovery that, you know, that's kind of in the past. Then we have this market we're going after, which is folks who do have an optimization problem and want to try to fix it, want to try to get to that product as quickly as possible. And I can give you an example. So you know, we work with Lonzatech, which is it's a great company. And, you know, they're one of the teams that's been around for a while now, and they're doing good work, and they basically have an extremophile that'll eat carbon monoxide and make ethanol. So that's great, but you want to make more ethanol, obviously. And you also want to re-engineer the little bug to make other high value chemicals. So the deal is, though, it's like doing a bunch of tests with carbon monoxide, which is a flammable gas, and it's difficult to do those tests, right? Especially in anything less than a, you know, very small tube. So what we can help them do is say, yeah, you've got those, you know, 100,000 clones in the freezer that you want to try, but I know it costs a fortune to try any of them. So let's just pull them out, you know, 100 at a time, and then see how we do. Feed the machine learning model, and the machine learning model will tell you which next 100 to pull out of the freezer. So, you know, you might do 10 iterations of 100 rather than, you know, going through all 100,000. And it's like a search type of thing. You know, if you're going to try to find the highest point in San Francisco, you're not going to go look at every square centimeter. You're going to look at every square kilometer, right?
And then, I just look at Google Maps. Software solutions.
So it's one application of these kind of methods that we've developed is to, you know, optimize a screen, if you will.
And for the people listening at home, if you want to learn a little more about what Lonzatech do, we had Marilyn Pavin on last year from Lonzatech, who is the bridge between the biologists and the software people, which is a very interesting podcast. Do check it out.
Yeah, she's our customer, actually.
Of course she would be. she recognizes the need. What is your biggest challenge then, would you say, right now, Mike?
I think managing growth. I mean, you know, our biggest challenges are really business ones. And we know what our customers want, and we know what we want to build. It's, you know, do you secure more capital and hire more people in order to build faster, or do you simply, you know, organically continue to build in collaboration with your partners, blah, blah, blah. Those kind of business challenges for them keep me up at night.
And on that note, Mike, you are a founder. I think the founder is always more on the technical side of things. You identify a problem, you want to build a solution, you want to build a company on that. You're also a CEO. And as you say, there's a load of other aspects, growth, strategy, and so on. how is life to be in those two positions at a company, and how do you deal with it? How do you make it as easy as possible for you and your team?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, it's there's sort of a schism, if you will. There are founder companies that are run by founders, and there are companies that aren't run by founders. And it's not clear, you know, what the right path is, but there are very different roles between, you know, sort of the founding team, what they have to do and where they have to take the company, and maybe a growth executive, you know, who's a professional CEO and comes with funding. He probably came in with the Series A or Series B or something like that. You know, there are different skill sets. I think you make a huge mistake if you assume you have to be a CEO of a company all the way up to IPO or something like that. That being said, I think some of the most successful companies are ones that managed to pull that off. You know, look at Emily LaProust at Twist. She did a great job. Mm-hmm. She just followed the roadmap almost to the T. And, you know, I talked to her once. She said, yeah, she just goes into board meetings and this is our milestones from last board meeting. This is what we've hit, all our milestones, and these are milestones for next meeting. Any questions?
Boom, boom, boom.
If not, let go for a drink.
Like, just don't give anybody any wiggle room. Just like, this is what we're doing, this is where we're going. She was very successful. I think, you know, the team at Benchling has done a very good job preparing their company, raising a lot of money and so forth. And that's a founding team. So it doesn't have to be, you don't have to import a CEO necessarily. I will say that correction, I am no longer the CEO.
Oh, okay.
I had a grandbaby about a year ago, almost exactly a year ago.
Oh, and congrats.
So my co-founder Eduardo is now the CEO of Selligent. Mm-hmm. So we're still a founding run team, but we don't have the imported CEO yet. No, I'm the president COO now. So I do everything except I don't have to talk to investors, which is nice. I love you, investors.
That's good.
It can get, I imagine it can, I don't want to say it gets boring exactly, but you're telling the same story, and it's a story you know inside out, it's a story you love, but you're telling it over and over. And how how did you feel stepping back into the COO role?
Well, we try to run an ego-free company, which is impossible, but you know, everyone has feelings and egos and stuff, but but you know, for me, with the arrival of the grandchild, and I'm down here in LA helping out, there's a term for it, it's called wraparound care. I just learned this.
Oh wow!
I need to make a note of that. Wraparound.
So yeah, my daughter is and her husband are both doctors. They're both residents. One at USC, one at UCLA. They're totally oversubscribed and frantic. Yeah, and so my wife and I watch the kid for 2 hours in the morning and 2 or 3 hours in the evening, and we're the wraparound care. So.
Oh wow.
Our job. But anyway, I thought it was probably irresponsible of me to take on that responsibility and try to keep up with the investor community and talk to them and cajole them and so forth. So I'm doing everything I used to do, but I don't have to entertain investors. So Eduardo's taking over that.
Cool. How long ago did you guys all found Tesselagen?
11 years ago.
Yeah. What was
10 years ago. Sorry.
But what was your biggest, maybe, I don't want to say setback. What was your biggest setback? No. What was your biggest learning experience in that time?
Well, there's the honest answer to those questions. And then there's the politically correct answer. Is the one you're going to hear. I mean, whenever you start a company, there's a lot of things you wish you could have done differently. And they're all the classic things that everybody knows about, so I won't bore you with them. But I will say that I think Tesselagen and a few other companies were early, and sometimes early is not the best. You want to, it's not bad, but we were one of the early companies that survived. A lot of them imploded or disappeared, like Cambrian Genomics or Genome Compiler or but I think we're one of the survivors from that early group of companies that came out of the synthetic biology early days, if you will. I mean, synthase is another one that survived. Riffin came along a little bit after us, but it's doing okay. So yeah, you just have to, you know, be careful and be smart and navigate the little glitches. That's all the classic things that go on in a startup company.
Absolutely. That's 10 years ago. That's a decade. It's quite a long time. But I think it's also inspiration for new founders. And within the CAP community, we also tend to get a lot of young people in there that do see a problem and want to build and set up their companies. I think you already mentioned about building a solution for an industry. I think it's very important to think about that from the early stages. Do you have any advice for people that are looking into setting up a company in our space, in the space of a software company within biology or a digital solution for biologists?
Yeah, I think I could say a few things about that. I would suggest that if they come from, like I did, from, you know, pretty heavy scientific background. I mean, I do have business experience because I was in industry for a while in software companies. So I kind of knew the drill when I went back into software. But a lot of kids are coming out, you know, at a point where they're a lot younger and may have no industry experience, but they're very smart. You're going to learn very quickly. The business side of it is not rocket science. However, if you ignore what the business people are trying to tell you, you will fail. Mm. You know, if you're kind of like, oh, I'm a PhD, I'm sort of the shit, you know, I don't have to pay attention to any of this stuff. You will fail. Absolutely. Because, you know, the business folks have learned a lot of these lessons through experience, and they're very happy to share. That's the one thing nice about the entrepreneur community and business people in general. They're pretty open, actually, willing to help. Just make sure that the help is unconditional. You know, you don't need these advisors who want a piece of your company and to get paid and stuff. Always go with your peers who are, you know, giving you advice for free, essentially, because they're your peers. Pay attention to what Y Combinator tried to teach young startups. You know, the lessons that have come out of some of these incubators are really important. Get into the best possible incubator and go for the highest, you know, AAA rated investors. You know, go for it. Don't like be bashful and it's not clear everyone's going to get invested by, you know, a big Sand Hill Road VC, but if they're interested in you and if you speak to what they are interested in, don't be shy about it. Go for it.
There was something you mentioned in our prep call about people who have like designed a solution to their own problem, thinking everybody must have this problem, which I thought was a very interesting viewpoint. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah, I think that's the sort of the classic, you know, academic thing. I just did my PhD. I did the particular modeling exercise for protein folding or some kind of thing. And, you know, you think that this is cool. You know, I start a company and commercialize it. And people's ambitions run the gamut. You know, a lot of people think, oh, I'll just set up a little company on the side and license this thing, right? Which is, I don't know. I wouldn't recommend that. If you're going to go into business, find a real need and do, you know, pay attention to the lessons that folks have been trying to teach you and, you know, go for it, you know. But a lot of people to have their little algorithm, they'll want to sort of, you know, make a company around it, but it's the algorithm, the code you wrote for your PhD is like a little kernel, you know, it's a little nucleus around which you're going to actually build the company, which is a much bigger thing. It gives you a little bit of credibility, gives you, you know, some patents maybe, but you're going to have to go out and find out, you know, in that you've already put yourself into a market niche, right? So now you have to build out around that market niche and say, is there something here that's a huge problem that I can solve?
You already hit on it when you said, you know, you got to find the need. And again, this kind of comes back to the earlier point of, you know, what are people's problems? And how do we address them? Because it's very easy to go to them with a solution, but if they don't understand how the solution works, especially if they're biologists who don't understand, you know, the software aspect of things, they're just going to scratch their heads and say, that's a neat solution, but I don't know what the problem is.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the old, you know, hammer looking for a nail type of problem. And, you know, I'll confess that most companies come about in that way because, you know, it's deep tech, right? And so you built a hammer for, you know, some problem, you had a nail. It doesn't necessarily mean it generalizes. You may say, oh, you know, I need a sort of meta language for this layer in a software stack. So I'm going to build a specification for a language. Okay, but who's going to use that language and what's it for? And what's its purpose in the value chain and all that kind of stuff? Or I mean, our company has the same origin story. We had an algorithm which could tell you the most efficient way to assemble DNA into to very long constructs. Well, who's the market for that? You know, three synthesis companies. So you have to kind of say, okay, well, that's not a big market. What is the real market here? What is the problems? What is the ultimate problem people are trying to solve when they're, you know, using long pieces of DNA to modify a microbe or a cell? So that's the exercise you have to go through.
Yeah, I think that's, would you say that's the difference between that kind of success and failure? The reason why Tesla-Gen and Synthase have succeeded where others have failed is because they've been able to adapt their hammer to suit other nails.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Or just understand, you know, what the nails are that I'm trying to hit and, yeah, you want to stretch this metaphor too far, I think, but
stretch it till it breaks.
Exactly. You have to understand the market, really. Mm-hmm. And the market has to be ready, right? I can't tell you how many times people have told us, well, you know, we're not automated yet, or we don't have enough data yet. It's just like, oh my God, tear your hair out. And that's where a company like Benchling was very smart. I mean, I think I'm just speculating. I have no knowledge of the inner workings of Benchling, but you know, when they started getting investor money, they probably got some advice, or maybe it's just their own internal research that said that we got to go for things that everybody needs. You know, everyone needs a place. Yep. Everyone has a lab notebook, right? And so let's do an ELN. And that was smart. That was smart to do that. Everyone has stuff in the freezer. Let's just track it for them, sample tracking. And so that became the kernel around which they could build their company. Now, you know, a lot of us said that ELNs are something people tried over and over and over again. They're always horrible and failed, but you know, try again. Eventually one of them is going to work and take off. And maybe that one's Benchling, you know?
No, I 100% agree with that. I think it's really important to be aware of, I'd say, bottlenecks within the industry. And if you engage with your end users, if you engage with the decision makers in such a way that you can find that out, I think in combination with the solution that you've got, you hit the jackpot. And I think, I totally agree with you. I think Benchling has done a really good job in identifying that.
I think we've hit a good time as well. There's a lot of the scientists that are kind of coming into the field now, they're very tech savvy. They've grown up with computers and apps, and it's second nature to them now. So they're much more readily able to adopt ELNs and other software tools. They think in software, which is pretty neat.
Yes, that's interesting. I had a conversation with someone, you know, I think a couple of weeks ago the other day, and he was talking about vendors and how vendors need to position their solutions to the next generation. Because think about it, all the people that you just mentioned, David, with all the technology that they grow up, they're going to be decision makers in, what is it, 5, 10, 15 years? Mm-hmm. Your solutions that you're building now needs to already be picked up by them that might be now working in the labs and making steps into manager roles and heads of, and eventually director or even up there. They will start making those decisions. So I think it's very important to position yourself as well, looking at the generation and say, okay, how does my solution fit with this generation? What are they looking for? What do they want to? What aspects do they value more than, for example, a generation X amount of years ago? We all know now they are more tech savvy. We all know majority of PhDs now starting into coding. I think they're now more, or not more, there's some really nice data on more postgraduates interested in doing computational PhDs mm-hmm. compared to wet lab. So yeah.
they recognize the need.
Yeah, exactly. So these are all aspects that especially companies that are building solutions, need to be aware of. And yeah, I think it's very important to address those things.
Is that something you guys are factoring in, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. It's a very, very important. And you know, what we see sometimes in the startup companies we're working with is that, you know, they get the 100 million and they hire, you know, they start to panic and say, oh, what are we gonna do with all this data? Let's hire a bunch of smart people. And so they hire some computational biologists and some bioinformaticists and some data scientists, some IT guys. And that's great. but often when you hire that nucleus of people, they're, you know, a lot of them, you know, kind of wish they'd start a software company, right? So they start building a software company inside this other startup company.
Yeah.
And so now you're creating a very bespoke solution that will only last as long as some of the people who are there at that company are there, because yeah, it's so sort of pasted and hand wired together that it's, you know, may not hang together over time. That being said, you know, what you mentioned is right. There's a new generation that's saying, hey, I know how integrations work and I know how tooling works. I can take the best of breed of these various, you know, platforms and things that work and integrate them. You know, it's not chewing gum and baling wire. It's actually really solid integration technologies that people have come up with in the last 10 years of, you know, some of them developed, say, at IBM that are amazing. And you can put systems together to look like they're all part of the same system. And that then you become a hero. You got your informatics platform built for your bosses in, you know, 6 months rather than 6 years. And, you know, it's a work of art. So that can only happen if the people supplying those chunks, you know, those modules, those things that are going to get integrated, do their job. And that's on us. You know, if we don't do our job, if we don't make it easy to integrate with, if we don't have a, you know, well-documented API or integration server, you know, they're not going to use our platform. They're not going to use it. It's just going to be too much of a hassle for them. So it really is on us as the vendors to be a part of that ecosystem and be responsive and do things the right way.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good note to end on, unless Fane has another question.
I was about to say the same thing. I think that's a great note to add on. Mike, thank you so much for joining us for Cap Talk. And it's great to learn more about your journey. And it's also great to hear your experiences and the things that you've encountered, and especially also how you combine your COO role together with your personal life. I think that's fascinating to hear. So what was the word you called for it again? I need to write it down.
I think it's called wraparound care.
Wraparound care. Okay.
Executive CXO wraparound care.
That's the new role.
I need someone to help me with my wraparound care. I need a wrap.
That's good. Thank you so much for joining us. And for the listeners that are interested in learning more about the Selligen, where would you direct them?
They can just go to the website, Selligen.com, check it out. It's hard to spell. It's not Teslagen, it's Teslagen, TESELAGEN.
Well, thank you all for listening to this episode of Cap Talk. Again, you can check out the Computer Aided Biology website at computeraidedbiology.com, and we will see you next time.